think of a famous explorer, and names like Columbus and Magellan pop up. Guys with boats. For centuries, ships were crucial to the exploration of our planet. Now a team of researchers has a plan for a boat that would explore another world, a spaceship that would literally sail on an alien sea.
NASA is getting ready to issue a call for proposals for what it calls its Discovery-class missions, relatively low-cost exploration projects.
They'll get all kinds of proposals to go all over the solar system, to comets, to asteroids, to the moon, to Venus.
Have you heard that anyone else is proposing a boat mission to another world?
Not that we know of.
Ellen Stofan heads up the team with the boat proposal. I met her at her home in Virginia. She's a planetary geologist who works for a company called Proxime Research. She says, in the past, space exploration has been done with spaceships that orbit planets or fly by them, or probes that land on a planet's surface and maybe drive around. So this new idea, floating in an extraterrestrial sea, has got people talking.
You know, the overwhelming reaction I get from scientists and engineers is, oh, that's really cool. I mean, people are just instantly kind of excited and intrigued to say, could we really go do this?
The answer is yes, at least on a moon of Saturn, Titan. Besides Earth, Titan is the only place in our solar system known to have bodies of liquid on its surface. A few years ago, a spacecraft orbiting Saturn sent back radar images of the northern polar regions of Titan. The images showed evidence of hundreds of lakes, some of them pretty big.
Think sort of the Black Sea on Earth, Lake Ontario, the Great Lakes. So some of them are actually that large.
That liquid isn't water, though. It's methane. On Earth, methane is a gas, but temperatures on Titan are super, super cold, minus 290 degrees Fahrenheit. Stofan says when it's that cold, methane is a liquid, sort of like gasoline.
And it turns out that, oddly enough, that methane acts just like water acts here on Earth. Methane forms clouds in the atmosphere. It rains down onto the surface and forms rivers, lakes, and seas.
She says, imagine you were standing on one of Titan's seashores.
The liquid that you would see would, to you, look like water. It would be fairly clear. So the landscape wouldn't look all that alien, except, of course, from the fact that there's no vegetation at those temperatures. And if you could see through the haze, you might see Saturn hanging off up in the sky, which would be quite a sight to see.
Okay, so now picture a boat floating on that weird lake. This boat is not going to look like the Mayflower.
It's certainly not going to look like what most people conceive of a boat looking like. It'll look more like a little capsule that floats.
Sort of like the bell-shaped capsules that the Apollo astronauts came home in. The vessel will have a mast.
But that's just to hold a camera. We won't have a sail.
But the wind would still push this craft around the lake. The probe could drift for months and months. It would have a small nuclear-powered engine, and it could shout its data directly back to Earth. Stofan says there's no danger of a shipwreck, because Titan's lakes have waves, but probably just gentle ones, unless there's a storm. Still, even that doesn't worry her.
In fact, we'd love for that to happen. Imagine, again, to be able to return an image showing a rainy day on Titan and to see those methane raindrops falling down into the lake. And the wind might kick up a little, but nothing as violent as sort of the tropical storms and hurricanes we get here on Earth.
She says, eventually, the ship might just run aground in a muddy beach and get stuck. Stofan says, all of this is technically doable. They could launch around 2016 and be sailing on Titan around 2022, if they win the competition to get funding from NASA. Her team is busy working up their proposal. She's supposed to go on vacation next week, but she doubts it will be totally relaxing. After all, she's going sailing with friends in Thailand.
Every time we turn the sailboat or anchor, I'm going to be thinking about our probe.
And what it would be like to be sailing instead on Titan. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
What do sardine populations, Wall Street, and Antarctica have in common? Well, the answer is they can all reach a critical moment, a tipping point, and change dramatically and unexpectedly. Fish populations can crash, markets obviously can too, and Antarctic ice shelves can melt with little warning. Those sudden changes have an enormous impact, so it would be great to know about them before they happen. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, some scientists believe the tipping points might be predictable.
At first blush, a financial market and a melting ice shelf may seem to be so utterly different that there's nothing to learn about one if you study the other. But look a little more closely, and there are deep patterns. Ice can stay stable for long periods of time, but with the right trigger, it can melt down rapidly. And George Sugihara at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography says we all know that financial markets can do the same.
What really sort of captures my imagination about all of this is the fact that you get similar kinds of behavior across many different kinds of systems.
Sugihara, like colleagues around the world, has been trying to describe mathematically how tipping points occur. And he's not just interested in what a system looks like as it goes over a catastrophic tipping point. He's interested in what happens right before that moment.
What's intriguing is that a lot of these things have similar precursors or similar early signals.
For example, in certain kinds of systems, there's an eerie quiet, the calm before the storm. Other systems behave differently. Financial markets start behaving erratically right before they reach a tipping point, he says.
There are a number of papers citing an increase in volatility just prior to a large systemic event, although there's some evidence to the contrary also.
The challenge is to look at a system that still seems to be stable and tell whether it's running headlong toward a tipping point. Sugihara is optimistic about our ability to predict that. He was among the authors of a recent report in the journal Nature that explores that possibility. And the stakes are huge. Think of possible tipping points in the global climate. A catastrophic change in Greenland ice melting could rapidly raise sea level. A dramatic shift in rainfall patterns could plunge areas into perennial drought. Ocean circulation shifts could actually make Europe get chilly.
These things all would make the impacts of climate change much worse if they were to occur.
That's Jonathan Overpeck at the University of Arizona.
So it'd be wonderful if we could see them coming.
Overpeck says, for example, water resource managers can plan ahead if they can tell the difference between a temporary drought and a permanent new climate regime. But advanced knowledge can only help so much. Say rainfall shifted away from the Amazon rainforest, as some scientists project. The result would be that one of the most lush, diverse, and productive ecosystems on Earth could turn into grassland.
That could occur very quickly in the matter of just, you know, years to decades.
If you could see that that was coming, would you still have time to do something about it?
Well, probably not.
And that's just one of the drawbacks about predicting ecological tipping points. Another is that it is really hard to do. Rob Jackson at Duke University says scientists have been on this quest for many decades.
Our track record in predicting tipping points, however, is weak. We missed the ozone hole. We missed the rapid melting of the North Pole in the last few years. And we missed last year's stock market crash. So I can't help but wonder, what will we miss this year?
Fortunately, you don't need to predict a specific catastrophe to make use of tipping point math. George Sugihara from Scripps says, for example, even if you can't predict that a particular fishery is on the verge of collapse, we know more broadly that laws that regulate fishing are pushing fish populations too close to their tipping points. And that's flirting with disaster.
Fishing up to the tipping point is a really bad idea. You want to fish well below the tipping point.
So he says we should revisit the laws that put these fisheries at risk. Sugihara says we also need better data for all systems that are in jeopardy. Unfortunately, in some cases, information is getting worse. For example, we're losing climate monitoring satellites faster than they're being replaced. And even the financial world has paid little attention to systemic tipping points, Sugihara says.
There's very little being thrown at this problem in any intelligent way. To me, that's a total mystery.
He's hoping this quiet field of research will reach its own tipping point and finally get the attention it needs. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Good news for the tens of millions of Americans who are colorblind. Scientists have used gene therapy to achieve full color vision in two monkeys that were born unable to tell red from green. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
The monkeys are male squirrel monkeys named Sam and Dalton. Jay Knights, a researcher at the University of Washington, says female squirrel monkeys can see the full range of colors, but males like Sam and Dalton can't.
For these monkeys, there's only two colors, blue and yellow. And if you mix blue and yellow to them, you just get a gray color.
That's because male squirrel monkeys are born without a receptor in their eyes that would let them see red and green.
Knights was part of a team that thought if they could get these monkeys to see the full spectrum, it might make it possible to do the same thing in people who are colorblind. The team developed a gene therapy technique that would reprogram some of the color receptors in the monkeys' eyes. But Knights knew that even if the therapy worked, there was no guarantee the monkeys' new eyes would be able to communicate with their old brains.
I went out and asked all my neuroscientist friends, if I do this in an adult monkey, will this give them color vision? And everyone said, absolutely not. Because just think about it, that you don't have any of the wires to carry the information. You don't have any of the circuitry to interpret it properly.
Knights and his team tried the experiment anyway. Dalton, named after the British scientist who originally described colorblindness, got treated first. For several months, there was no change. Every day, Dalton tried to win a juice reward by touching a red or green target on a computer screen, and every day he failed. Knights was anxious, but not surprised. Previous experiments had shown that it took about 5 months to reprogram a critical mass of receptor cells. Then, just about 5 months after his gene therapy, Dalton started hitting the target every time.
At first, we told ourselves, you know, maybe he's just guessing really well today or something. But over a few days, it became very clear that he wasn't just guessing. That floored us.
Later on, the other squirrel monkey, Sam, would have a similar epiphany. Knight says both monkeys have seemed pretty pleased with themselves ever since.
It's just like a kid that goes in and they don't want to get wrong answers on a test. The monkeys kind of act that way. And they're very happy to be straight-A students now.
Scientists who study color vision are calling the story of Sam and Dalton dazzling and surprising. Jerry Jacobs from the University of California, Santa Barbara, says it's remarkable that the technique worked at all on an adult animal. Earlier research had shown that after childhood, the brain loses much of its ability to adapt to new types of visual information. But Jacobs says color seems to be different. The adult brains of even colorblind monkeys and humans appear ready to receive new color input.
The primate is really almost an ideal place to have this happen because they have a pathway through the retina which in most primates is almost designed to extract color information.
Robert Shapley of New York University says what amazed him was how quickly the monkeys' brains responded once the reprogrammed cells began working.
As soon as that happened, the animals were able to start doing color discrimination. I mean, it was like with almost no delay. That was really striking.
Shapley says that bodes well for people with color blindness.
There's no reason to think that these monkeys and humans are dramatically different in the way that they are interpreting color signals from the eye.
And researchers say gene therapy might eventually offer a way to treat a range of vision problems. The new research appears in the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
From antelope meat to crocodile boots, the illegal trade in wildlife products is a multi-billion dollar business. It's a difficult trade to stop, in part because authorities often can't tell whether a frozen hunk of meat or a skin comes from a protected animal or not. But as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, there's a technology that could give wildlife investigators a new tool to identify what kind of animal a product came from, even from a single scale or feather.
The key to this whole idea is DNA. DNA from animals and insects. It's stored here. Yes.
This is the real bowels of the museum, isn't it?
It really is. You can sort of all the pipes and wires and ducts and everything.
George Amato is an evolutionary biologist, and he works at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. It's 19th century, a gigantic stone castle of a building. We're somewhere deep in the basement. Amato is going to show me something called the Barcode of Life Data System. The system's guts, if you will, is a storehouse of frozen animal tissue.
Everything from microbes to whales.
In a locked room stand 7 steel canisters. They look like 6-foot-tall thermoses.
We have about 70,000 samples right now. We have a continuous influx.
Julie Feinstein keeps everything inside those thermoses cooled with liquid nitrogen. Scientists from around the world have been sending samples here for years, from rainforests in Costa Rica or museum drawers in Chicago. Amato opens one canister to see inside.
We'll make sure that you don't either freeze your nose or your hands to the side of the vat. So
each holds boxes of tiny vials, bits of butterfly wings, whale blubber, you name it. They're analyzing them to build up a reference library of DNA from different species.
We get DNA from feathers. They could be blood samples, skin samples, or for smaller organisms, we might have the whole organism.
What Amato and his colleagues want to do now is use bits of this DNA library to curb trade in endangered wildlife. Here's how it would work. Let's say you're a customs agent who's found a hunk of meat in a suitcase. You don't know if it's a dike or antelope or hamburger, so you send a bit of it to Amato. What Amato has identified is a particular sequence of DNA in every animal that seems to be unique to every species. He calls it a DNA barcode. So a dike or antelope has a barcode that's different from other antelopes, or cows for that matter. Amato compares the DNA from the customs agent to the DNA in his library and knows right away if the meat is legal. A lot of the trade that wildlife authorities want to stop is in bush meat. It can be anything from antelope to monkey. Biologist Mitch Eaton at the U.S. Geological Survey has documented the trade in the forests of Central Africa.
These regions are becoming more and more global. It's not just local hunting that's happening anymore. The increase in pressure on these forests for economic, commercial purposes is growing very quickly.
Eaton says wildlife investigators need a tool to figure out what's okay for local consumption and what's prohibited for trading across international borders, whether it's meat or refined products like skins.
If these things are being transported as refined products or pieces of wildlife and they have no ability to tell what species it actually is, they would be able to use this technology, and it takes all of the guesswork out, really.
These are leather products that were confiscated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and sent to us.
In the DNA lab at the Natural History Museum in New York, Amato pulls down a box of handbags, briefcases, shoes. The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service provided them so Amato could test his barcode technology. Because the leather goods have been processed or preserved in some way, it's hard to get clean DNA, but the barcoding still works some of the time.
This pair of boots, you can see where we've removed one of the scales to do the isolation. These boots, I think, we looked online, they sold for $4,000 a pair. I think they were supposed to be made out of Nile crocodile. I have to see. Yeah.
Amato's team has just described its barcode technique in the journal Conservation Genetics. Amato says they've already identified illegal imports of whale, dolphin meat, and even smoked monkey. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
You love me today, yeah. Then you're gone tomorrow. First you bring me joy, and then you bring me sorrow. I never know just what you are thinking of. I don't want no part-time love. You tell me the truth, and then you tell